Sunday in New York City, and this is State of the Union on 91.5 WNYE FM. I'm Chris Policano. DC 37 is New York City's largest public employee union with 125,000 members and nearly 50,000 retirees. We're part of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, also known as AFSCME. We're on the air Sundays at 8 p.m. and we rebroadcast Wednesdays at 1:30 p.m. We are also now available as a podcast on iTunes. Simply go to your podcast app on your iPhone or iPad and search for DC 37 State of the Union. And DC 37 members, there are now more ways to stay in touch with your union. You can follow us on social media on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Check out our website, www.dc37.net. And every month, keep a lookout for your union newspaper, the Public Employee Press, in your mailbox. We've got a good show for you this evening. We also implore to keep, because this is a recorded show, we don't get to do live phone calls, but we do try to keep as interactive as possible. Anything you hear, any comments you want to make, please send us a line at stateoftheunion@dc37.net. Our first guest this evening is Ed Ott, distinguished lecturer at the Murphy Institute of CUNY. Welcome back to the show, sir.
Very nice to talk to you again.
You know, we do this, I talk about trying to get emails from listeners, and we often get folks, you know, much of the email is about people's own personal issues, you know, work-related issues, and benefits issues, and they want some help maneuvering through the union, and we're always thrilled to do that. But I got two emails this week. One of them was about politics and unions. And the fellow obviously listens to this show and says, you're very political on your show, and why is that? And I was wondering if you had any thoughts about why it's so important in the year 2017 for unions to be active in politics.
Actually, I got to tell you, I don't think there's any choice. And and public sector workers have understood this for a long time. And even though the labor movement is very diminished in the private sector, it kind of lends itself to them having to engage in politics more directly. And here's why. For a public sector union, I always talk to this about my students over at the Murphy Institute. The mayor is kind of like the CEO of the company, and the legislature is kind of the board. Public sector workers don't have the luxury of ignoring the political structure because they are their employers, and they set their wage standards, their pension standards, their health care standards, et cetera. So they've always kind of been in the political process in very direct ways. But in general, for working people right now, as the unions weakened in the private sector, public policy gains that were made from the 30s on, things like Social Security, are consistently under attack. The latest health care fight. The health care standards of the American working class are impacted greatly by what politicians do. We don't have the luxury of ignoring politics. We wish we did. We'd rather spend our money on other things, maybe sending more workers to college and retraining programs. But we spend exorbitant amounts trying to protect what we have. So I always say this is not something that we really need to debate. It's imposed on us by the attacks on our standards, and we have to protect ourselves.
And there's a great quote. I hope I get this right. A writer named Robert Cruikshank wrote a piece a number of years ago, and I've always loved this quote. It was talking about things that were going on in politics in California and union involvement. And the quote was, unions are not some alien special interest group trying to impose their will on the people of California. Unions are the people of California. And
yes, they are. And unions are one of the institutions of democracy. It's why the attack on unions from the right has been so important. For instance, if you go back to the Reagan era and the first Bush era, when Bennett was the commissioner, the secretary of education. He was asked about unions, and he said, look, I'm not particularly anti-union, but they're in the way.
Right.
They wanted to restructure public education and get rid of it if they could, and the unions were in the way. They wanted to defeat them. And that's why so much of the political structure, Republicans and Democrats, so many of them are at best indifferent and often hostile to unions. It's because we are one of the forces that can stop them from doing whatever they want.
The last line of defense, in fact. And who else is going to do it? I mean, we are at a time in our lives when, with the inequality issue, which brings me to my second email that came in today. Why are you guys so big on inequality? I've got nothing against billionaires. This is America, and everybody's got this is why we come to America. This is why people have always come to America, to get very rich. And and the opportunity to do that is unique to America. What do you think about that?
Well, I would ask that person, the next billionaire that they run into, to ask them why is it that they hate poor people so much?
Right. That's awful. Yeah,
which is the real question. I don't understand. Why are billionaires looking to get more billions by taking away Medicaid, who helps 50% of the children in this country are on Medicaid? The bulk of the working class that finds themselves elderly and in need of health care and nursing homes are on Medicaid. Why do the billionaires have to find another $179 billion in tax cuts at the expense of poor people? One of the things that's very interesting, and one of your other public sector unions years ago, they did an interview with six workers about Mayor Bloomberg, and this was during Bloomberg's first term. And Mike Bloomberg was known for going away weekends. He'd leave the city and he'd check out down to his place in Bermuda, I think it was.
Yep.
Five of the six workers all said, when asked, do you think it's a good thing for Michael Bloomberg to go away? Five of the six said in various ways, oh, no, I wouldn't go to Bermuda. I would have gone to St. Thomas, or I would have gone to Puerto Rico. And the truth of the matter is American workers don't begrudge billionaires what they have. And some suffer the illusion that they will get there someday, but they don't begrudge them what they have. What the fight is about is that what they have is never seems to be enough. We've got corporations that have had it all their own way for 40 years, and they want more. We've been cutting taxes and, in turn, cutting services for four decades now, and it's still not enough. For them, there is no bottom to the pot. They just keep digging deeper.
That great scene at the end of the movie Chinatown with Jack Nicholson and John Huston, where Nicholson says to Huston, and Huston plays this, evil, multimillionaire character, probably one of the most evil characters in the history of film, by the way. He says, how much are you worth? Are you worth $10 million? And John Huston says, oh my, yes. And he said, and remember, this is the 1930s, and Jack Nicholson says, what more do you want? What more can you buy? How much better can you eat? What do you want? And he says, the future, Mr. Gitz, the future. And that seems to me like a prophetic. That's a 1974 movie, and it seems to me as accurate then as it is today.
I would agree, and that's really it. They want to control the future.
And this idea that it will trickle down, that if billionaires do better and have more, that the rest of us will benefit from that. That idea over the past 30 years has been so totally blown out of the water. And as you say, we do not begrudge the rich. This has always been a country where people aspire to be rich. But how the rules of the game have been rigged seems to me, and how that shot at upward mobility has been lost over the past 30 years, seems to me like something that we all have to wake up to. Would you agree, sir?
I would agree. The only other thing I would point out is when you get all this failed social policy, and, you know, let's face it, union members are better off in many ways than non-union members in that they have a modicum of security, they have some health care, and in a place like New York, we still have pensions. But even with all that, and with some opportunity for education, we have to confront failed social policy every day. The homeless situation in the city, it's life-threatening to the poor, but it is an assault on the living standards and the quality of life of your average working person. When you have to come out the door every day, or you go through Grand Central Station or Penn Station, and you see the level of poverty and suffering on the streets, it assaults your dignity and affects your quality of life. Part of what the fight is about and the reason why you want to use tax policy, if you will, to redistribute some of this income is you want to elevate the quality of life for everybody. Public schools, public libraries all help make it a little easier to be poor. Decent public housing would help solve some of the homelessness problem. And without more public housing, we're never going to solve it. For the middle class, we have a stake in elevating the poor, and we have to try to get there.
And where there are unions, and we try to point this out as often as possible, it is not just the union. Where there is high union density, it is not just the union member who is benefiting from that. All the workers, where there are strong unions, benefit from the presence of unions.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's a message that we have to begin to go back to the basics and reinforce among your average working person. First comes organization, and you organize around the question of dignity and respect. The money comes later, but it pulls up everybody. For all these people who talk about trickle-down economics, it's absolute nonsense. You need broad social and political organizations that seek to elevate everybody. We didn't get the reforms we got in the 30s, late 30s, 40s, early 50s without there being a massive political threat to capitalism itself. And that's why they made those concessions. That's why we ended up with Social Security. It's why we ended up with union labor rights, because they were terrified that world socialism was going to come and take everything that they had. So they made some concessions. Then they started to feel like they didn't want to pay it anymore. They didn't want to pay the freight, and they started taking it back, and they're dismantling everything. We also have a global economy that you can get lost in quite quickly. But in the end, unions, regardless of the economic and political system, are necessary for workers to have representation, a voice, if you will, to be able to protect themselves and, frankly, to advance for the next generation.
Ed Ott, distinguished lecturer at the Murphy Institute of CUNY. You know, I knew this conversation was going to go by in a flash, and it just did. Listen, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me anytime. It's always a pleasure.
We will do this again.
Thank you.
And we'll be right back. We're back. This is State of the Union, the District Council 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. Anything you want, any comments you want to make, please send them to stateoftheunion@dc37.net. This week, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell delayed the vote on the unpopular Senate Healthcare Reform Bill, which is supposed to replace or repeal the Affordable Care Act until after the Senate's July 4th recess. McConnell had intended to hold the vote before the recess, but delayed it because of a lack of support within his own caucus. This week, the nation's Joan Walsh wrote a piece on the issue titled, "Mitch McConnell's Healthcare Setback is a Big Effin' Deal." Welcome to the show, Joan.
Thank you, Chris.
Welcome back to the show.
Yes.
Welcome back. So how big an effing deal is this, what's happened in the Senate?
I think it's a very big deal because he thought he could pull this together, you know, without hearings in a week, and because the nature of the resistance came on both flanks, you know, his centrist people as well as the right, you know, Ted Cruz and Mike Lee and Rand Paul, et cetera. And, you know, he put something together that was so unpopular. He had people scurrying from both sides. But I also think it was really the result of renewed activism, you know, on the ground. You know, we suffered a real setback when we thought we had a victory over the House bill. Paul Ryan pulled that. Paul Ryan told us Obamacare will be with us for the foreseeable future. You know, they got back to the House and they started cobbling together something worse than the original bill. But a lot of people thought, you know, well, we won and it's over, and they stopped calling their Congress folks. And so, you know, they got energized and activated again for this Senate bill. You know, one of my worries, since you know me, I'm a worrier,
mm-hmm.
Is that it is a partial attempt to let the grassroots die down, go have a fun 4th of July, you know, stay away from your phones, so that they can make some deals, you know, more deals in secret, and, you know, eventually pass something maybe not as odious but pretty close. So, you know, we've just got to be really vigilant about watching every move and every giveaway, every buy-off to a wobbly senator. The issue is it's pretty hard to placate the more centrist folks who are concerned about Medicaid expansion. You know, Susan Collins has made it sound like there's no circumstance under which she would vote for the bill in its current structure. Other people like, you know, Shelley Moore Capito in West Virginia, she could possibly be bought off by a much larger pool of spending on the treatment of opioid addiction. You know, she's somebody who may not have big problems with giving a tax cut to the wealthiest and slashing care, but on that specific issue where people have begun to get organized, she, you know, she might say, oh, well, I brought, you know, $20 billion into the state for this treatment. That's probably a lot. But, you know, here's a big pot of money,
right,
and we're setting up, you know, the Mitch McConnell Treatment Center, and, you know, everything's going to be fine.
Let's do me a favor. Let's make it clear. Let's take a step back and make it clear what it is that's in this bill and why it's so unpopular. Like,
sure. I mean, one of the biggest things, and I apparently, you know, some moderate, I have a hard time with that word because almost none of them are really moderates, but one senator in their meeting with Trump did say that you know, our side was successfully portraying it as a massive tax cut for the wealthy, you know, that was basically using Medicaid funding, that it's almost one-to-one. It's, you know, $700 billion tax cut and a $700-something billion Medicaid cut.
That's like we're taking from Medicaid and we're giving millionaires tax cuts.
More obvious,
yeah, right.
You know, and the top 0.1%, they would get a $250,000 tax cut from this bill. There are no tax cuts for the middle class or even upper middle class. It's really it's slashing the taxes that were imposed by Obamacare in order to help fund the Medicaid expansion. So that's a big thing. And then there is the issue of the Medicaid expansion, which has been, in states that have taken it, it's been very successful. It's worked really well. And I think more people have begun to see that it's not just a program for the very poor. It's mainly a program for poor children and the elderly who were formerly middle class, but you know, get to a point where they spend down, you know, all of their savings, and in order to afford, you know, a retirement home or even some form of in-home care, they need to go on Medicaid. So that actually makes up about two-thirds of the expenses is you know, people later in life who need a lot of care, more than Medicare provides.
The thing about health care is there's no them in this, because we get sick.
We're age. All us, right,
that's right. There's no them, there's no they. And among the biggest consequences, according to the CBO, is 15 million people lose their health insurance next year.
I mean, right, that quickly. You know, the place where the other thing that it does, it's very sneaky. It says, you know, you can't discriminate against folks with pre-existing conditions. That's technically true in the bill, but they also allow states to seek waivers for how they regulate insurance, and they allow states to say to insurance companies, you know what, you no longer have to provide a basic, what are called essential health benefits, which range from maternity care to chemotherapy and mental health care and all, you know, all these other things that you could buy packages that contain these carve-outs that when you needed some kind of care, you didn't have it because you didn't know you're going to need it, so you didn't pay for it. I mean, no one's ever gotten pregnant accidentally, of course.
Right.
You know, so what this does, Chris, why this relates to folks with pre-existing conditions is it will make comprehensive insurance like we all have now the most expensive kind of insurance. And it'll only be purchased by the sick who already have problems. And therefore, it will just be unbelievably unaffordable. The House bill plays with high risk pools, but we've done that before, and they don't work either. They still wind up being incredibly expensive for the person or the family that has a pre-existing condition. So it's really, they've learned on the Senate side, they learned how to do some things that obscured how bad it is. But basically, if you're in a red state and your governor wants to, you know, give insurance companies carte blanche to go back to selling crappy policies that cover basically nothing, you're good. They're good, you know. And that's one of the kind of poorly understood facets of the Affordable Care Act, was that it made insurance real insurance. You had to cover these life stage events, and sure, you know, you either got subsidies, you made your own decisions about co-pays and deductibles, and some of the deductibles are ridiculously high. And, you know, if there was interest, there are lots of things that could be done to improve on the Affordable Care Act, but these bills do none of them.
I saw a tweet, ABC News tweeted that McConnell was warning his caucus that if they didn't get their acts together, we were going to have to do something in a bipartisanship fashion, which, and the tweet was, you know, McConnell warns about bipartisanship, as if bipartisanship has become the worst thing that could possibly happen in Washington,
D.C. Well, he made it that way, right? You know, the day Obama was inaugurated, I mean, he committed Republicans in the Senate, and, you know, Boehner mostly went along with him in the House, and then Ryan, to not work with anything, not work with President Obama and the Democrats on anything. So it's pretty rich, you know, especially Trump is always complaining about the do-nothing Democrats, they're obstructionists. I mean, Mitch McConnell taught us obstruction. And so, you know, one thing that I think has been important is that, you know, Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer have been able to keep their caucuses together. There have been nobody's gone rogue and said, you know, for example, let's collaborate with the Collins Cassidy bill. Nobody has said, let the centrists, you know, on the in the Democratic Party and the Republican Party come together to craft things. The red state senators who can sometimes be wobbly, Heidi Heitkamp, no dream of going rogue. I just don't think that they can do anything. You know, I heard Schumer respond to the notion. I mean, Collins and Murkowski and even Lindsey Graham and John McCain are saying it's time to be bipartisan on this. I don't see it. Not because I oppose to bipartisanship. I think for some tough things we need it. You know, we're going to meet in the middle. I consider the Affordable Care Act a meeting in the middle, except, you know, the Democrats worked so hard. They took so many amendments, hundreds of amendments from Republicans, and then the Republicans, you know, none of them voted for the bill. But anyway, I think that it would be very difficult. Schumer said, you know, we'll collaborate, you know, but here are our terms. No repeal of Obamacare, only, you know, improving it. No cutting of the Medicaid expansion. Those are two things that, you know, I guess you could get, you know, and if you augmented the exchanges or, you know, maybe you could get 48 Democrats and 3 Republicans, but I think McConnell would find a way to shut that down.
Now,
that would be a victory for Schumer, not for Trump. They don't want to do anything that they can't describe to their base as repealing and replacing.
And the craziness of this is there is an Affordable Care Act that needs work, that needs to be fixed, that needs to be tweaked, that needs to, and everybody knew that when it got passed. These things are works in progress, right? And experience tells you, and this is like 101 stuff. This is basic stuff. But because it's the Affordable Care Act, because it has Barack Obama's name so associated with it, they have to blow the whole thing up.
Right. They can't help fix it. Nope.
And by a 2-to-1 margin, according to the Quinnipiac poll, recent Quinnipiac poll, the American public does not want them to do what they're doing. And yet they move forward with this, like this delay this weekend. We've only got about a minute or so to wrap this up. But this delay, what do they think they're going to do with this delay? Do they really think we're just going to stop? That's what you said a few minutes ago, is that your concern is that folks are going to go.
Two things. Folks will get distracted. Folks will think this is a victory and move on. And he'll also have time to craft. He's got a lot of money to play with, because it cut like $200 billion more than the House bill did, unbelievably. So he really could throw, you know, tens of billions of dollars at people for their specific pet peeve, whatever it is. You know, opioids
like using,
over here.
Yeah, using states that are being plagued by drug addiction right now and dangling that in front of the senators.
Right. That could get him 2 or 3 votes. And, you know, I think the problem is getting a bill that both the right and the center will agree on. I still don't know that he has enough smarts or money to do that. It's going to be hard.
All right. Joan Walsh is you are an author, but you also wrote Mitch McConnell's Healthcare Setback is a Big Effing Deal in the Nation this week. MSNBC contributor and a good friend. And you will come back again, my dear.
I certainly will.
Thank you very much.
Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
And that's all the time we have for this week. The producer is Rudy Orozco. The engineer is Andrea Minocchio. I'm Chris Policano. Until next time, ciao.